It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll look at some of the questions being raised now that a case of Ebola has been diagnosed here in the United States.
First, solitary confinement in America's prisons has come under increasing scrutiny in recent years. Prison officials say the practice is needed for security and safety, but our next guests and others have raised concerns that solitary confinement is inhumane and overused in the prison system. The faith group Wisdom held a protest earlier today at the state capitol to draw attention to the issue.
We have a member of Wisdom with us now in the studio. Reverend Jerry Hancock is director of the Prison Ministry Project for the First Congregational United Church of Christ in Madison. Reverend Hancock, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, you have described solitary confinement as a form of torture. Why?
By international standards, the United Nations, for example, defines any time in solitary confinement longer than 15 days as torture. And in 2012, the Wisconsin Department of Corrections kept 4,000 inmates in solitary confinement for more than 30 days. So by international definition, the Department of Corrections is routinely and as a matter of policy engaging in torture.
Is there an appropriate use of solitary confinement if it's, say, under that 15-day threshold?
You can imagine that solitary confinement might be necessary to evaluate a prisoner, to segregate some prisoners for a short period of time, but it needs to be seen simply as a diagnostic tool, not as a treatment tool or management tool.
And do you worry that it's being used also as a punishment tool?
Right. And that's very disturbing, because you would think that prison by itself was punishment enough without adding the additional burden of solitary confinement. And just to be clear, what we're talking about here is being locked in a cell about 10 feet long by 6 feet wide by yourself, alone, without any human contact for 23 hours a day. The 24th hour is spent in what might be called rec, which means being let outside by yourself into what amounts to a dog kennel for an hour. So solitary confinement means solitary confinement with no relief.
And what is the impact that this long-term solitary confinement or segregation has on an inmate?
Well, research has shown that if you are mentally ill, and some reports have shown that as much as 60% of the population in solitary confinement in Wisconsin may suffer serious mental illness before they go into solitary confinement. So if you go in with a serious mental illness, it makes it considerably worse. If you don't have mental illness and are locked in a cell by yourself for weeks, months, sometimes even years, you're very likely to develop serious mental illness. And that's what the research has proven over the last 10 years.
Now, connected to today's protests, you set up a cell at a church near the Capitol, and I gather that'll be showing up elsewhere. Why?
Well, actually, Rob, we set up the cell originally on the steps of the Capitol, because if you're going to end solitary confinement, if you're going to end the torture in Wisconsin prisons, the first thing you have to do is make it visible. And that was our goal today, to make solitary confinement visible. So we had an exact replica of a solitary confinement cell on the steps of the Capitol so that people could come and see what it looked like. Not only see what it looked like, but hear what it sounds like. Because solitary confinement is not a quiet place. There's constant yelling, screaming, banging. And we actually had a tape that was done by Frontline of sounds from solitary confinement. And we wanted to be on the Capitol as a way of speaking truth to power. We actually invited Governor Walker to come by and spend an hour in solitary.
How did people react when they went in and sat and I guess just waited in this cell?
Well, there were two kinds of reactions. For the general public, they were generally appalled and terrified by the experience. The guys that helped us build the cell were people that had actually spent time in solitary. And when they saw the cell, their blood ran cold. It was that scary for them. So those were two kinds of reactions that I think verified the fact that the cell on the Capitol steps was in fact the real deal.
How do inmates who have been in solitary confinement for a long period of time, how do they talk about it?
They talk about it as a near-death experience. They talk about, they use phrases like eating away at your soul, depression, hopelessness, trying to find any way to survive.
A lot of people might think, well, these people have committed crimes, theoretically serious crimes, to be in this position. Is there a lot of sympathy for their suffering if they've in fact inflicted suffering on others to get into prison in the first place?
Well, Wisdom, the interfaith group Wisdom, of which I'm a part, is very concerned about victims and healing the harm that's been done to victims, and looking at that harm from a very broad perspective, not only from the standpoint of the immediate victim, but the community as well. And we work very hard in terms of restorative justice to deal with those issues. To your question, though, it's important to remember that 99% of the people in prison are going to be returning to the community. So the question is, do we want them to come out better or worse? It's very clear that long periods in solitary confinement make people worse.
You talked about how much Wisconsin uses solitary confinement. Are we the norm nationwide, or are we an outlier? Are we behind the curve on solitary confinement?
We are falling increasingly behind the curve. Other states, for example, Maine, New York, and most importantly, Colorado, have made significant strides in reducing the use of solitary confinement. And if we have a minute, I'd really like to talk about the experience in Colorado.
Yeah.
Because it's so relevant.
Well, they've got our former Department of Corrections head there.
Right, exactly. And in fact, not only the former head of the Department of Corrections, but the elected Republican sheriff of Dane County. Rick Ramish was the Republican sheriff of Dane County. Then he became the head of the Wisconsin Department of Corrections under Governor Jim Doyle. He then went to Colorado after the head of corrections in Colorado was assassinated by an inmate who was released from prison after spending a long period of time in solitary. So Ramish goes to Colorado, and one of the first things he does is to spend a night in solitary confinement. And he wrote a brilliant op-ed piece for the New York Times saying this has to stop, that we cannot put people in this situation and expect our communities to be safe when they come out.
So what has Colorado done? How have they changed things there?
Colorado has really emphasized mental health treatment and evaluating the mental health status of inmates they place in solitary confinement. And that's critical.
We're talking about solitary confinement here in Wisconsin prisons, with Reverend Jerry Hancock of the United Church of Christ. He's a member of the group Wisdom, which organized a protest at the Capitol today.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you share our guest's concern about solitary confinement, or do you think it needs to be an option for maintaining safety and security in prison? If you've been in prison or worked in a prison, please call in and share your thoughts on the subject. It's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation with Reverend Jerry Hancock right now from the group Wisdom, which led a protest at the Capitol today against solitary confinement in Wisconsin's prison system.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the continued use of solitary confinement in prisons in Wisconsin, in the United States? Do you think it's an appropriate tool for the Department of Corrections? Have you worked or been in prison? What are your thoughts? 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now. We've got Josh on the line in La Crosse. Josh, hi.
Hi.
What do you think, Josh?
Basically, let me start off with saying I've been in prison before, and I actually spent 6 months in solitary confinement. And it wasn't because a guard didn't like me and put me there. It was because I did something that got me there. And the type of people that are in solitary confinement are not your, nice guy, pot dealer guy. They're hardened criminals. I mean, they're the kind of guys who come into prison with the attitude that I'm going to make life hard here. We don't see, and when those guys go into solitary, they don't come out any different. They go in there, and they're wild, and they're crazy in there. And they do it because they like that. They like the attention.
Josh, thanks for the call and for sharing your experience. So if Josh is right, aren't other prisoners safer? Aren't guards safer if these violent criminals are in solitary?
I think we need to be clear about where we should start to deal with this issue. We know that 60% of the people that are in solitary confinement, at least, for example, in the prison at Waupun, have serious mental illness. What I would suggest we do is get those seriously mentally ill inmates out of solitary and into some sort of appropriate treatment methodology, and then see who's left and see what kinds of programming or safety issues we need to address, and address those with the full understanding that 99% of those people are coming out of prison. And so what can we do to make them better when they come out and make our community safer? So let's start by getting people that are seriously mentally ill out of solitary confinement.
Josh, thanks for the call. We'll go now to John in Shawano. John, you're on the air.
Hello. Yeah. Your guest has the nail or the hammer on the nail right there. It's all about mental illness in both crime on the streets and dealing within the correctional institutions. Back in the 90s, way back in the day, I worked at Ethan Allen School, which unfortunately now is closed down. My technical term was a youth counselor too, but I was a member of the correctional institution, and what I dealt with were young men dealing with all sorts of mental problems. Dealing from you can run the gamut, and it's dealing with them psychologically. Not physically. Unfortunately, I had to do that at the same time. My only one souvenir from those days working for Department of Corrections is by pair of handcuffs.
John, thanks for sharing the calls. He says starting even in juvenile corrections, more focus is needed on mental health.
I think that's true, and we need to look at the way we use the criminal justice system as the default for serious mental health issues, and we're seeing that here in Dane County, for example, with the issue of building a new jail. And Sheriff Maloney, who is a terrific guy and absolutely humane in his view of this, says, look, if you're going to keep sending me all these mentally ill people, at least build me a facility where I can treat them humanely. And that facility is going to cost $130 million a year. So we need to seriously look at the way we're dealing with the mentally ill in the entire criminal justice system.
John, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Kevin with us in Milwaukee. Kevin, hi.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I am calling to let you guys know in the 90s, in the early part of the 90s, I did fracture the law and was sent to Ethan Allen School for Boys in the state of Wisconsin. I know that is closed down now, and had an experience there to where I was having suicidal thoughts, and I was put into solitary confinement for that reason. And I was in the way they treated the children in there. I mean, I was young, I was scared. I was in there without my parents. And I know I did something to get put in there, but I needed someone to talk to. I needed things on that order. I did not need to be put into physical restraints. I had no clothes on, stripped from food, things on that order. I mean, it was just a horrible experience. It was really traumatizing, and it was the effects on it. And I'd like to know what your expert feels on that as far as the children having to have to go through that. And I will take the comments off air. Thank you.
Kevin, thanks for sharing your experience. Reverend Hancock, do we know, are we still using solitary confinement in the juvenile correctional system?
The juvenile correctional system has been transformed dramatically over the past few years. The problem has been that more and more juveniles are turning up in the adult system. We have one story of a man that we know very well here in Dane County who went to prison when he was 15 years old and spent 10 years in solitary confinement. The more important question I think that Kevin raises is the issue of suicide. And we hear lots of stories about people attempting suicide while in solitary confinement. And the most insightful story I think that we've heard is of the man who attempted to commit suicide by hanging himself in his cell, a solitary confinement cell, and the guards appropriately came in and tried to cut him down and save his life. But because he was suicidal, he resisted the guards. The prison's response to that was to put him in solitary confinement for another 360 days. You cannot use solitary confinement as treatment for mental illness. It doesn't work.
Time for one more call with Marie on the line in Madison. Marie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to relay that I had a son who went to prison, and the last time I had seen him when he was in prison, he had beautiful locks. And by the time he got out of prison, having served time, extended time, in solitary confinement, I barely recognized him because he was completely bald. All of his hair fell out in solitary confinement, and he was basically telling me about how they stripped him naked and how humiliating it was. And I just don't see how that helps. And my understanding of the reason why he was put in there, it was very bogus. And I just, as a mother, I just don't understand how this is allowed to go on.
Marie, thanks for the call. That kind of effect on people, you must have heard from parents, too.
Today at the rally at the Capitol, we had two sets of parents talk about the treatment their sons have received in solitary confinement. And they were the same stories that Marie related. And her question is, why is this allowed? And that's really the question we are asking today. Why is this allowed? In the state of Wisconsin, where we spend $1 billion a year on corrections, why is torture an acceptable public policy? And we were calling on the governor to end that. And the governor has the authority to end that today.
Reverend Hancock, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
I've been speaking with Reverend Jerry Hancock. He's director of the Prison Ministry Project for the United Church of Christ, and he's involved with the group Wisdom. They advocate for prison reform, and they held a protest at the Capitol on the issue of solitary confinement. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
First, yesterday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention confirmed the first case of Ebola in the United States. While CDC officials have said they have plans in place to isolate and treat any Ebola patients in the U.S., our next guest says the announcement is likely to cause a good deal of worry, maybe panic around the country.
However, he says the case brings up some ethical questions that need to be talked about in a calm and productive way.
Joining us now is Arthur Kaplan. He's the director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University Langone Medical Center. Arthur, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, you say that people are going to feel a fair amount of panic surrounding this announcement. I mean, do we have good cause to be worried, if not panicked?
We don't have any reason to be panicked. I think there's reason to pay attention. I don't expect that a lot of folks are going to intersect Ebola. There are many other health things, health problems, just the ordinary flu, for example. We're just entering flu season. They're going to pose more challenges. But you want to make sure that people understand exactly what's happening with that patient in Dallas. You want the details, not the names or the addresses. I think that's wrong to give any of that out. But here's what happened. Here's how we're tracking it. Here's how we're dealing with it. This is where they went. This is who they contacted. This is who we're tracing. You need that story because you got to make sure people trust that you're really on top of this.
And you've written a piece that appeared in Forbes called Five Ethical Points Now That Ebola Has Entered the U.S., and that actually was one of your points. You're looking for clear and transparent communication from the CDC and other public health officials. Why is that so important?
I think the CDC attitude and some of the health officials in Texas has been, we're on it, trust us, we are taking this very seriously, and the boots are on the ground. But I think a lot of folks are a little bit skeptical. Maybe some, maybe not a lot, but some are skeptical, and they are going to say, you know, maybe you're not telling us all the truth, or maybe you're covering something up. So I think the way you cement that trust is you get as transparent as possible. You don't say, we can't give you any details because of privacy. What you do say is, we're not going to give any names, we're not going to give any addresses, we're not going to give you anything that would disclose where these people are. But we can tell you the story of what we're doing, and then you'll buy in and see, yeah, you really are on top of this.
Now, on one practical level, there have been, one instant reaction sometimes is, let's close down travel from the countries affected by Ebola. You don't buy that. What are you looking for instead?
So I don't think that makes much sense, partly because boats and planes can get here from other countries. We're not going to shut down all travel that is going to come here, and people from Africa can come the long way around and still get here pretty quickly. So I don't think you're going to see a complete air traffic shutdown. What you could see is some advice, for example, what I haven't seen yet for passengers. If you see someone who's sick or sweaty or throwing up on the plane, it might be important to know who to say something to. I fully support that. I think that's prudent. Better screening. We should make sure that before you get on the plane, you get asked a series of questions about symptoms. When you get off the plane, you should be asked a series of questions about symptoms and where you've been and what countries you've been through and all that. Much more aggressive. We did it a little bit, if you remember, for pandemic flu. We should be doing it much more aggressively for Ebola.
Now, this first case in Texas was detected in a hospital after a first try where the patient evidently was sent home. Are local hospitals around the country knowing what to look out for and what to do if there's a possible case of Ebola?
Can't answer that, and that's another problem. I think the public should know not only what are they doing at the CDC, which is great, but what's happening in Milwaukee? What's actually happening in hospitals all around the country? Is your local hospital ready to deal with an Ebola patient? If an Ebola patient wound up visiting someone in Wisconsin and became very sick, should they be taken to the Mayo Clinic? Should they go to someplace in Atlanta? Or can the local facility absolutely isolate them and handle that situation. We haven't heard about training of the hospitals. We haven't heard about the admission priorities of hospitals. We ought to know that. So I'm not happy with that public communication either.
Are hospitals ready to deal with a lot of people seeing these stories in the media, getting worried that the cold or mild flu might be Ebola and flooding urgent care centers, emergency rooms?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really worries me. So where we are right now, start of October, is the beginning of the flu season. Most people hear that the early symptoms of Ebola are flu-like symptoms. They may not be paying attention to the fact that you don't have to worry too much about this if you haven't been in Western Africa or you haven't been taking care of someone with Ebola. They just hear flu-like symptoms and off they go. So, no, I don't think, again, we're doing enough communication to say, yeah, you want to watch for those flu-like symptoms if you've been exposed to someone because you're trying to take care of them. That's usually a healthcare worker, or you've traveled. I worry at the start of the flu season that we're also not saying, hey, this is really the year to get the flu shot because you might as well weed yourself out of that set of symptoms so you don't overwhelm the system even further. You know, the ERs during flu season are jammed. And if we have more people trying to get in there because they have false fears about Ebola, it's really going to make a mess.
Getting back to your recommendations, you see we need to clarify the rights of families to dictate disposal of bodies should there be a death related to Ebola. Why is that important?
If you looked at the terrible epidemic in West Africa, it's clear that the reason it has spread far is that they have not handled dead bodies in ways that would prevent transmission of the disease. It's not that people are giving each other the disease through fluid contact, although certainly some have, but they have a dead body that's still infectious. It's got a lot of virus still in it, and they caress the body, and they wrap the body, and they bathe the body, and they kiss the body, and that's where trouble starts. You can't deal with dead bodies that way if they die of Ebola. You're going to have to pretty much get them isolated and then cremate them. So I don't think we're going to have a lot of choices if someone dies here and they say religiously or culturally, I want to have this kind of funeral or I want to do this or that. That can't happen, and we might as well say that clearly now.
So this is a case where on the ethics side, the balance should be public safety over a religious or cultural freedom.
Exactly.
And then finally, and obviously when we talk the healthcare system in the United States, cost always comes up. Have we talked about how we're going to pay for Ebola screening, Ebola treatment, should it become more necessary?
We haven't, and that's another problem, and here's why. Let's say you were someone who was a visitor here and you got sick and you're thinking, I don't know if they're going to pay for my care, and I don't want to burden my family that's here or my relatives. I'll just stay home until I'm really sure that I'm sick. You don't want to do that. You don't want people who are here illegally and somehow get exposed not to go into the hospital. You want everybody to go to the hospital if they really show these severe signs of vomiting and diarrhea and the inability to walk and so forth, and they've been in places where Ebola has been. So we better make it clear that we're happy to take care of everybody, no matter whether they're insured or they're not insured, because the worst thing you can do is mimic what we've seen in Western Africa, which is people staying at home, dying at home, and infecting their families.
Now, big picture, you've pointed out a lot of flaws in communication in part, in decisions that are as yet unmade. By and large, our public health system, do you think it's ready for a threat like Ebola, that it won't spread as quickly as it did, as you mentioned, in those West African countries?
It's far more ready than those West African countries, but it's not where it should be. We don't have good outreach into the hospitals to make sure that every resident knows that when you take a history from someone with flu-like symptoms, you want to ask them where they've traveled. We don't really have a tough, aggressive public health system that can do surveillance accurately of what's going on. We've chopped the budget up and cut back. It isn't where it should be. And a lesson just down the road, whether it's Ebola or tuberculosis or some other disease that's highly infectious, you got to beef that public health system back up. We're in a small world and things move quick, and we can't get by with a public health system that sort of ends at our borders.
Arthur, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, my pleasure.
That's Arthur Kaplan. He's director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University Langone Medical Center. He joins us to talk about the first case of Ebola diagnosed in the U.S. and the ethical points that, and some practical ones, too, that need to be discussed going forward. It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. A lot of polling sources show that a GOP takeover of the Senate is increasingly likely. Early in September, it looked much closer.
And the Secret Service is taking heat from Congress over significant slip-ups, including a White House intruder armed with a knife, and some breaking news there about Julia Pearson, director of Secret Service.
And closer to home, the House Office of Congressional Ethics concluded yesterday that there's substantial reason to believe that Wisconsin Representative Tom Petri broke House ethics rules.
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, welcome back.
How you doing, Veronica? Good talking to you.
Doing well, thanks. So let's get to this news that just broke in the last half hour. So Julia Pearson, director of the Secret Service, has resigned. Now, earlier it was reported that she had not been asked to resign. She faced some tough grilling, but that was not on the table. What happened?
Well, you know, starting this morning, Democrats, including the senior Democratic member of that committee that grilled her yesterday, began to say they thought that they had lost confidence in her. She had lost the confidence of the American people and of the agency that she led, and it was time for her to step down. And at 4 o'clock Eastern time, which is right about now, Senator Schumer, who's a leader in the Democratic Party, was going to have a press conference calling for her resignation. She beat him to the punch by about an hour and announced that she was stepping down. And I mean, I think the fact of the matter is that obviously the Secret Service has been, you know, repeatedly buffeted by a scandal over the past couple of years. The fact that they got this fence jumper made it all the way into the middle of the White House, and then yesterday there was another revelation that a security guard who was carrying a gun and was a convicted felon ended up in an elevator with President Obama, and the White House did not find that out until it was reported in the newspaper yesterday. I think it became time to go.
And there were the gunshots at the White House that were only discovered much after the fact by a cleaning crew, apparently.
Yeah. She was saying during the testimony yesterday that she felt actually the Secret Service responded appropriately to that incident because, her point, they heard the shots outside and responded to the shots and the shooter, but they thought that the shots were directed at a bunch of people on the street. They thought a gunfight had broken out on the street. So they were chasing people outside, not realizing that a bullet had traveled into the White House. I, you know, can't judge whether that would have been something that should have been obvious to them. I just don't know. But obviously that testimony was met with some derision in Congress.
How long had she been in that position?
About a year and a half, because remember, they had recently had a scandal at the Secret Service with Secret Service officers hiring prostitutes while on detail in, I think it was Columbia, if I'm remembering correctly. And part of the response to that problem was they really believed there was an old boys network at the Secret Service that allowed poor behavior by agents, and Obama appointed Pearson, the first woman to hold that position, in part as a way to sort of changing of the guard and to clearing out the old boys network. So she was a short-timer in this post, and now they're going to have to go find somebody else.
Right. So any idea what sort of direction the White House will be looking, given this latest try didn't work out?
No idea. At the moment, they've appointed some guy as a temporary whose name has escaped me right now, but he's was a former head of security at Comcast, the cable company, but he also is a former Secret Service agent, but he most recently had been in retirement and working for Comcast. I do not know where you go look for a Secret Service head at this point. I think it's a little too early to tell for that.
Now, as far as you know, has this kind of thing ever happened before? For example, has someone made it into the White House armed and overpowered an agent inside?
No, not so far as I know. I mean, there have been these kind of problems before. I mean, you may recall, I don't remember what year it was, but it was a decade or so ago that an armed intruder made it into the U.S. Capitol and wrestled with the guards and was running down the hall towards one of the House leadership offices and was shot in the hallway by Capitol Police. And two Capitol Police officers were killed by that intruder that day, which led to a beefing up of security at the U.S. Capitol building. That was a great tragedy, and those two officers are still enshrined in a plaque in the Capitol building. So, It happens. You know, I mean, the fact of the matter is that none of our security systems are ever impenetrable. You know, I think the good news in this particular case is that this guy got over the fence, got into the building, and was unable to do any damage to anybody. It's not clear he was really armed to do much damage. He had a knife, but no bombs, no guns.
And it looks like Joseph Clancy is being tapped to be the interim replacement at this time. We're going to move on now and talk about the scene for the November elections. And polls are showing a change now that the race, instead of being very tight, neck and neck for the Senate, is looking as though the GOP has the leg up. What's happened?
Yeah, I don't believe that poll.
It's a bunch of polls, though, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the problem. Nationally, it's a state-by-state issue. The national averages are really hard to assess because every state is different. Right now, something very weird is going on in Kansas. We have a new poll out today suggesting that the independent might win that race, not the Republican, not the Democrat. The Democrat actually dropped off the ballot. There is a race in North Carolina. It looked like the Democrat was in serious trouble. Now the Democrat may be actually creeping a little bit ahead. Where the Democrats seem to be in real trouble is in Louisiana and Arkansas, where the incumbent Democrats are really struggling. And, by the way, I should mention, every time something bad happens in the White House, like this Secret Service thing that sort of paints a picture of incompetence in the government and the government that the Democrats are running, it hurts Democrats' chances. I know that's a complicated thought, but basically, if the Democrats need people to go out and vote for Democrats, they need people to be excited about voting for Democrats. And when the Democrats who run the government end up looking like goofballs, it's hard to get people to the polls. So, yeah, my impression is that the needle is moving in several races in Republican favor, but the needle is also moving in Democrats' favor in a couple of these races as well. And it's just impossible to tell on a national average whether Republicans are going to win or lose. It's going to be a state-by-state issue in a half dozen seats.
So you're not putting your money on any of these polls, even though it's Nate Silver, Paul.
Yeah, well, and I don't put any money on any of the polls because particularly in state polling, there's all kinds of flaws in the polls. They're very small pools. You're talking about most of these races are within the margin of error of the poll. You know, I do not put my faith in anything until people reach for the lever and pull it. Until then, it's all speculation. Informed speculation, absolutely, but all speculation.
He's got a pretty safe position at this point. Well, let's talk a little bit about money, because as I understand it, as it's being reported, Democrats and Republicans saying, the sky is falling, we need more money, the other side has more of it, donate now. So what's happening with the money scene?
The money scene is interesting because, as I know your listeners are familiar, after this Citizens United case a couple of years ago, outside third-party money has begun flooding into congressional races. You know, we'll spend $1 billion of outside money this year on Senate and congressional races. So, everybody is sending out emails saying the sky is falling, the sky is falling. And, in fact, what's happening is it's like an arms race. Everybody needs more money to keep up with the last guy's money. And it is money for advertising. It is money for door-to-door campaigns. You're talking about those races where Democrats are in trouble. The Democrats are spending millions of dollars on phone banks, on door-to-door door-knocking efforts, on voter outreach and registration. They are trying to move a ground game that will get people to the polls and save them in a couple places. That's what they're all begging for money for. They need to fund a get-out-the-vote machine. And that starts now. A lot of these places, voting has already begun. Early voting has already begun.
Now, looking at some Wisconsin news in the House yesterday, the House Office of Congressional Ethics concluded that there is substantial reason to believe that Representative Tom Petri broke House ethics rules.
Right.
What did he do?
My colleague Donovan Slack actually broke this story that Petri was going to agencies of the government to intervene on behalf of companies in which he owned stock. And it looks like he was buying stock somewhere around the time that government actions that he knew about were taking place that benefited the stock. And so we're not saying that he, you know, immediately went out of his way to try and enrich himself. We're saying is he took actions he shouldn't have taken that benefited companies that he owned stock in. And what the Office of Congressional Ethics reviewed the stories that Donovan had written and concluded that, in fact, Petri had violated a conflict of interest rule by getting actively involved in stock in companies that he had an ownership position. Now, they're just recommending that the House Ethics Committee look into this further. They can't actually punish him. And Petri has since announced that he's not going to run for re-election,
right,
in part, we think, because of this investigation.
All right, Paul, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Veronica. Have a great day.
You too. We've been talking to Paul Singer, USA Today politics editor. He joins us every week at this time to break down what's happening in Congress.